Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Weird Era, a literary podcast where we ask the right questions. I am so excited to be joined today by the icon and legend, Brontës Pernell, to discuss his latest book, 10 Bridges I've Burnt. Brontës is the author of several books, most recently 100 Boyfriends, which won the 2022 Lambda Literary Award in Gay Fiction, was longlisted for the 2022 Mark Twain American Voice in Literature Award and the 2021 Brooklyn Public Library Literary Prize, and was named an editor's choice by the New York Times Book Review. Pernell is the frontman for the band Younger Lovers and a renowned dancer, performance artist, and zine maker. Born in Triana, Alabama, he's lived in Oakland, California for two decades. In 10 Bridges I've Burnt, Brontës Pernell, the bard of the underloved and overlooked, turns his gaze inward. A storyteller with a musical eye for the absurdity of his own existence, he's peerless in his ability to find the levity within the stormiest of crises. Here, in his first collection of genre-defying verse, Pernell reflects on his peripatetic life, whose ups and downs have nothing on the turmoil within. Quote, "The most high-risk homosexual behavior I engage in," he writes, "is simply existing." The 38 autobiographical pieces pulsing in 10 Bridges I've Burnt find Pernell at his no-holds-barred best. He remembers a vicious brawl he participated in at a poetry conference and reckons with packaging his trauma for TV writers' rooms, wrestles with the curses and gifts passed down from generations of family members, and chronicles with breathless verve a list of hell-raising misadventures and sexcapades. Through it all, he muses on everything from love and loneliness to capitalism and blackness to jogging and the ethics of art, always with unpredictable clarity and movement. With the same balance of wit and wisdom that made 100 Boyfriends a sensation, Pernell unleashes another collection of boundary-pushing writing with 10 Bridges I've Burnt, a book as original and thrilling as the author himself. Hi, Brontës. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, so I'm going to start by asking you why you decided to write 10 Bridges as a memoir in verse, quote. I don't want to ask you, you know, why not just write a traditional memoir, because I don't particularly see you as a traditionalist, so I think that answer is probably too obvious. I might ask you instead, is this you kind of reshaping memoir to suit your own needs?
Oh my God, my favorite band, one of my favorite bands growing up was the Cold Cold Hearts, and one of their songs is just like, "This is a work of fiction. Space and time have been rearranged to suit my convenience," which honestly, I definitely think most memoir is fiction. Our relationality to people kind of, I think it kind of always renders us unreliable narrators to someone. Mm. But also I don't even think that that's really what's important. I think stories in general always have something to teach us, memoir, fiction, whatever. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I question why people like memoir, or why it's like, you know, what exactly is the thing about it where they feel like this is the most authentic form of like mm-hmm. writing or storytelling. And also there's a pack of fucking lies all through 10 Bridges I Burnt, because I wanted to be in the Zora Neale Hurston tradition. Zora Neale Hurston wrote a quote unquote memoir that was actually like a fictionalized story, but was it a fictionalized story because she did that on purpose, or because even when writing memoir, you have to still have like a level of protection for other people and right. yourself, right? It's tricky. But I kind of wanted to play with the, like, I kind of wanted to play with the idea of it. And the idea of composites, and the idea that, you know, and I say it all the time, it's just like, people always want, like, marginalized people to be writing memoir, because they always want to, like, you know, live out our lives. It's like some kind of, like, vicarious pulp fiction adventure. And sometimes I'm just kind of like, no, fuck that. Plus, you only know what I tell you anyway. That's the problem with all writers, so...
How did your history with songwriting come into play with it? And, you know, like, I, even when I was writing this interview, it was kind of like, do I refer to them as poems? They're referred to as pieces in several points. Could they be songs also? What's your thought on that?
No, because when I'm writing songs, it's just like, musicality is so different. And it's just like, these are like, sometimes I feel like these are like my most fragmented of connected thoughts. This is not the way I would songwrite. Like, the vowel sounds, the syllables, all of it is just, it's so fucking different. But yes, they are indeed poems. Poems can look a lot of ways. But what was so funny, too, is, like, watching people receive this volume. And, like, some people who I just, they're just, like, they're so shocked. They're just like, oh, like, this behaves in a way that I didn't think poetry could. I'm just like, what the fuck? What poets were you reading? Because this, like, this reminds me of all the fucking dangerous bitches I used to read, you know? I'm also probably, like, more allied with, like, and I said this before, like, battle rap. Like, I love listening to, like, rappers, like, freestyles where they're, like, going in. And I'm like, I'm like, poetry should have bars, like, actual bars. Like, some people really think they're supposed to pick up, like, poetry and eat it over a salad and watch the river go and just be like, oh, this divine epiphany. But, like, I think you should pick up poetry and be like, oh! Like, come on.
In the poem, Tommy Chin, after hitting this titular character in the head with a glass pitcher at the San Francisco Young Gay Poets Luncheon, you write, quote, "In my defense, I just had to signify that poetry is still dangerous." When did poetry stop being dangerous, in your opinion, and how are you helping to keep it dangerous?
Oh, I just felt like writing that. I didn't think I was, like, in charge of anything. Like,
but if you were,
it just seemed like a lovely way to end a poem. I don't know if I feel like all literature is dangerous because it arms people with power and, like, license. You know, hence why they do everything to curb our literacy, which is another reason I don't want to update my iPhone. Like, I don't know what's destroying books faster than people scrolling all day, or fair, like, enough, what's destroying actual literature, critical thinking, all this type of shit. But I also, I do think there was a time when poetry was more, like, revered, or it was definitely something that I grew up with, or, like, it was something to aspire to. And then, but it's also weird moving from 100 Boyfriends to this book. How many people feel comfortable saying, like, oh, well, I just don't really like poetry, or I've never liked poetry? And I'm like, oh, this is why we're in an age of godless whores. Like, y'all's writing isn't from a, like, actual, like, spiritual place. Like, I was, like, someone, like, I was taught by one teacher of mine where it was like, I'm not the type of person that's going to turn to a Bible. I'm going to turn to, like, my favorite volume of poetry where everything is kind of, like, right there, you know? And you can tell when someone, you can tell when a writer doesn't like poetry, right? Like, because there's something about writing that I think is supposed to have, like, syllables, metaphor, punchlines, syllables per minute, all these things that poetry allows for, as opposed to someone just, like, giving a TED Talk in writing. Do you understand?
Right. Yeah.
And so it's weird that people even, it's weird that people would even separate those two things that much. I always thought they all just kind of went hand in hand, but I think I like that that's being revealed to me, how differently people felt about it, or how close this thing, how close I felt to this kind of form of writing that I think actually kind of alienates a lot of a significant amount of people, or they feel like they don't have access to it. But Hopefully they feel like they'll have more access to mine. Hopefully. We'll see.
And I think that's a really good point, too. I think so many people find poetry inaccessible because it requires you to think. And nobody really wants to do that now.
No, for sure. You know, I always do think that, like, there's this kind of charge or this, like, kind of, like, spiritual lineage I have with, like, colloquialism in writing. Like, I remember, like, when I was younger, reading about, like, the Harlem Niggerati, and the reason, like, their biggest critiques or the reason they hated Zora was because she actually tried to write the way Black people spoke, and it was considered deeply déclassé. The fact that Langston Hughes tried to actually write, tried to compose in a kind of jazz lyricism was considered deeply déclassé. Like, that was the thing. And I don't know, it's like, there is this way where, like, I think that a lot of writing is about the idea that people are, like, handing the voice of God to the peasants, right? Like, but if you, like, if you're talking in a way where you're, like, kikiing with your best friends, it's mm-hmm. not viewed as an intellectual rigor, when in actuality, right. I think it takes the most rigor. So there's, like, kind of this thing that I always face where, I don't know, the word fun is used a lot because, yeah, I'm definitely fun, you know? I'm definitely fucking fun. I'm a fucking, I am an exciting mistress to have. But, you know, I don't know. The subject matter is anything but sometimes. So mm-hmm. I feel like I'm always, like, kind of, like, riding this line. But at the end of the day, if, you know, my whole life people have called me D-class A in some form or way, and it was nothing, it had nothing to do other than people always, in order to feel like intellectuals, always have feel like they have to have a 30,000 foot view over you. You know,
right.
This kind of weird, like, surveillance or, you know, a way to look down. But I'm at a point now where it's like, well, if you really need that, go right ahead. But I don't know. I feel like there's a whole landscape to change. Or we're always trying to shift consciousness, you know, little by little. And I don't know. I think that's something I'm more interested in than, I don't know, fucking writing the Pulitzer Prize winning book. Even though I feel like I have.
Of your generation. I mean, if there's, like, a semi-autobiographical element to each of your books, how much, especially now with 10 Bridges out in the world, how much do you think your audience knows you? And, you know, I think I'm kind of asking, how much does voyeurism come into play with what you share with an audience? And, you know, I would even go so far as to bring in, you know, your social media presence into that as well. How well do you think your audience knows you, and do you want them to know you?
I don't know how much people feel like they know. It's like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of things I do are just, like, for fun or to keep myself not bored. And to be honest, if I wrote, like, an actual factual memoir about my life, I just think it would be, like, so earnest and boring and horrible. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, the actual facts are probably, I don't know, either not that fun or not that entertaining, actually. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, too, I think, alongside voyeurism, I do think that there's a lot more people that think along the lines, like, I don't know, sometimes I'm always given this thing where people are like, oh, like, these criminal thoughts that this writer has is so whatever. But it's like, I think a lot of people, I do not believe the way I think is, like, this exceptional way of thinking. I think a lot of people, a lot more people than we know, are actually closer to something like that. And I think it actually gives people, I don't know, I think it gives people license to that kind of area of their brain, you know?
Yeah.
What we could be calling voyeurism could also be called reassurance, I think, for a lot of people. But I mean, it's a big question. I wouldn't actually know how to answer it. However they are receiving it is really not up to me. You know, but it's something that I mostly do, quite honestly, for myself, to keep myself entertained. And so that's the actual goal. And I hit it more often than not. So
you have this whole exploration of your relationship with your parents in 10 Bridges. You talk about your parents a lot in there. There was a particular line in the piece, Neurodivergence versus Moral Deficit Defined, that I just want to highlight here. Quote, since my brain still came from my parents, I'm going to take the liberty of blaming those, though well-meaning, motherfuckers for any discomfort I feel from now into my last breath on Earth. I love that you included there in parentheses, well-meaning. Can you just talk about what it means to be empathetic with our parents or sympathetic to our parents? And if that's something you've always had or if it came later on with maybe some work and some time.
Well, yeah, that's another thing too, because it's like, I feel like in those poems, I'm never actually taking actual aim at my, like, my personal parents per se. What I'm having aim with is like our parents' generation in general and how every generation of parent watches the world change right in front of their eyes and how easily the old way of thinking turns way into a new way of thinking, and then they realize, wait, I've done everything wrong. Sometimes I feel that I don't even have children, but I do feel like, I think around the time you hit 40, there's always this generational shift, you know, that kind of happens, and you're just like, oh shit, like, what the fuck has my life actually been, you know? I actually don't have a problem with my parents anymore. Like, it took me, you know, when we're younger, we're like angry and unforgiving and unsympathetic. But then, you know, we get older, and luckily, if we have parents that change also, we do see how many of our problems had less to do with the personal and actually more to do with the structural surroundings of this is the confines of what the society told you to do with your kid, you know. I could, for instance, I don't know how many gay boys I know sit there and fucking, like, you know, say, like, our parents had, like, these homophobic tendencies or tried to do this, that, the other, no matter how much they loved us, right? But then also, too, especially for us older boys, I can't imagine how fucking frightening it must have been having a little fucking gay kid and being like, oh, God, like, I have to keep this faggot alive. Like, if someone isn't going to gay bash him, he might catch AIDS or something. Or, like, you know, really having that be, like, frightening fucking thought and doing everything outside of, you know, super harmful things to, like, control that fucking wave of hate from the world coming from us, you know, coming at us. I can't even really imagine. So, of course. And, like, so many of my friends, like, feel comfortable, like, going to therapy all the time and finding new ways to blame their parents for everything. sometimes I like to just go ahead and blame myself. Like, I was a stuck-up little faggot. like, in my poor parents, nothing was ever good enough. I was always judging. I was always watching PBS, thinking I was so smart. Like, it was, it was hard. So...
I keep hearing, I feel like there's this sentiment that's kind of emerging where people maybe that are getting older, that are having kids now, are kind of realizing, we blamed our parents for all of this shit. But everybody's just living life for the first time.
Well, I mean, or perhaps the second or third, I don't know, but fucking definitely learning new lessons in each.
In another poem, If I Had a Time Machine, I Would Kill My Parents, you do say, quote, our parents defy therapy. Can you just kind of talk on that a little bit more? And maybe here we can talk to, you know, the listeners who completely disagree with what we're saying right now.
Oh, God, no, I just... well, I think the way that poem, the line after that is, I doubt sitting in some room with some white man will alleviate the 60 plus years of muscle memory trauma this person has. And I do think that's true. I think if therapy actually worked, I would have been better a long time ago. And the problem with therapy is that, like, people think that once you go and confess your sins, everything is fine. But, you know, it's kind of like I learned in my art program, like, you can't have all theory and no practice. I can go and confess my sins all I want, but when I leave that therapy room, you actually have to do the work of changing which is like a more like it's a body-based practice. It's a fucking thing you have to commit to. It's like it's really, really hard, you know. And so when I say like they defy therapy, it's just like it's not just about confessing their sins. It's about a lived practice of like being in a body and having to redirect like the mistakes made and how you're still living those out and forging new paths to keep everything. It's like, I really do think like some of our parents defy therapy, but that doesn't, I don't think that that means that they are like necessarily unforgivable or godless. I just think, I don't know. I think it's really fucking hard to exist, you know? So
out of curiosity, I know there's a line, I'm going to paraphrase it now, but it's something like, I've fathered so many of my friends. Would you ever have kids, or do you think that relationship with fathering your friends is feeding you in the way that maybe some people think having children would?
I don't know. There was a couple of years ago during quarantine where I really, really, really thought about, having kids, or it became something that was on the radar a lot. You know, I definitely, there's enough kids around. And I also think like when you become like, when you live as a man and you become like over the age of 40, like everybody puts you in this paternal role, whether you want to be there or not, because,
right,
you know, I just don't, the world just doesn't have enough identifiable father figures. And I think, you know, the culture of manhood closes a lot of men off. Mm. So people don't actually have access to just, you know, an actual loving man in their life. And, you know, you will be put there by an unimaginable amount of people, you know. I used to think that, like, as I got older, that, like, you know, I used to believe in, like, oh, my God, my twink death is coming. I don't, you know, but, like, at 40 now, it's, like, unimaginable the amount of, like, love and attention I get that comes from this whole other different place, you know?
Right.
So, I don't know. I do have, like, kind of, like, this weird middle, this other type of midlife crisis where I do sometimes sit there and be like, oh, like, I really actually chose, like, the artist path. Like, like that whole thing of, like, I don't know, having a husband, having kids, having, like, a house of my own. Like, it's really getting to that point where it's, like, I didn't make enough of the right choices at the certain forks in the road to do that. Yeah. Which is like, fine, you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like there's plenty of men who did make those choices. And, you know, the midlife crisis is always about what you didn't do, right? So,
ooh, fair.
I have this mix of thinking about, in between the fact that, yes, this is the life we chose for ourselves, alongside the fact that I honestly think, like most human beings, I made the only choices I really could considering my circumstances, you know. So reconciling these kind of two facts, all I can tell you is I have no real answer to this question.
In the poem, Sociopath by Proxy, you talk about periodically turning to hookers. And again, I'm going to highlight another line here. Quote, more so, I'm generally too tired from work to be witty or charming all the time. So, like generations upon generations upon generations of men with my level of emotional fatigue, I turn to hookers. End quote. And I know this isn't the same thing, but I don't know, something in that line kind of made me want to ask you about how you feel about the rise of online sex work and OnlyFans, and whether or not you think there's like a new school and an old school of sex work, and yeah, how you feel about that, where you think it's heading, where what you like and what you dislike about these things. And I'd also love to hear your thoughts on incel culture through that lens.
Incel culture comes from the fact that these kind of vulgar fucking trolls really think by access of their malehood, they're supposed to have access to like free pussy. their entire lives, which has actually always been a goddamn lie. It's like, men paid for everything. You know, the whole the whole scope of like male supremacy, women not being able, you know, femhood in general not being able to get jobs or whatever, is that men had to pay for everything. You know, when you watch that show Mad Men, right? I often say that I think, you know, who said this? Penny Arcade Sex said this. She said, like, the sexual revolution cheapened sex. And I really do believe that. Like, if this were the fucking 50s, like, it's like, and you were someone's mistress, they had to pay your rent. Like, like being a wife or, you know what I'm saying? Like, but then also cut to today, it's like, every fucking random grifter thinks that you should be paying them for like the most mundane and horrible sexual experience of their lives, you know, like, like too many people, it's supposed to be like some hookers, right? But when everyone has a hooker mentality, again, it cheapens the whole process, right? Like, hookerism is like a job. It's like an actual fucking trade about like being charming, being funny, being witty. You know, I say this as someone who was one once. It's like, you're supposed to make your customer, like, feel like he's, like, a very valuable and desired man, you know? Like, that's gone. Everyone thinks, like, all they gotta do is flash some abs, and it's like, even some babies that are just like, pay me $10 a month to watch you have sex, and you go on these OnlyFans site, and you see these dead-eyed, fucking muscular flight attendant looking motherfuckers having the most boring sex you've ever seen in your entire goddamn life. I'm just like, the whole fucking system is poisoned. Furthermore, we still have to pay. We always have to pay. We pay to keep our dicks wet, right? It's whether you're going to a bathhouse, right? Or think of how many times you've gone on a date with someone, you know, just to be able to fuck. You don't want to be a fucking, you know, like a piece of shit about it, but like by the third date, you've shelled out $300 or more and like haven't gotten to the thing you want. Sometimes I think hookers just cut the middleman out. You'll be like, here's $150. Can you dick me down and get the fuck out of my life? It's way more efficient if you think about it. I was explaining this to my mom because my mom thought it was just the and thus again, society thinks it's so shameful and horrible that a man turned to a hooker. Like, what is wrong with him? And I'm just like, we are men. We are busy. Sometimes we pay for it just to have it on our own time and to get it over with, rather than to play this kind of horrible game of romance that's been polluted by both capitalism, the world around us, the lies we've been told about relationality, you know. That's the best way I know how to explain it. Also too, it's like not like I like it's not like these are things that were mostly happening when I was like writing for TV and like dealing with hookers like in LA, and then like realistically too, by the third or fourth time you hire them, they become like boyfriends. They show up later and later. They want more and more for less and less. And you're just like, oh, I don't want to like hang out with
people. I don't actually want to date you.
No, exactly. And like that's what they will start to want. And you're like, oh God, you can't get away from this at any like you can't get away from this at any gesture. Even when I'm just like trying to pay and go away, someone's still just like, but what about us? So
oh man, this is exactly why I wanted to ask you this question, though, because I knew I was going to get an excellent answer out of it. I would also love to talk for a second about that beautiful moment where she was a gender neutral term. I loved that piece in the book, especially the line, quote, every living object became feminine. What are your thoughts on the language of the internet and that constant evolution? Is it tiring? Does it interest you?
No, it's just, I mean, it's just human life and experience. It's kind of like watching our parents realize that they raised us wrong. Like, in 20 or 30 years, they, them might become like absolutely poisonous to say. We don't know. I mean, we used to say Negro, right? then one day that like changed. So I think, I don't know, I think evolution of language and us redefining or reconstantly drawing the line in the sand is, it's great. It's what's supposed to happen, hopefully.
So. And in that same kind of vein, how do you feel about the commercialization of, you know, let's say something like Drag Race and the language surrounding it, which comes, again, so strongly from the historically Black ballroom culture scene? Yeah, what are your thoughts around that?
Well, it's hard. Like, you know, it used to be that the only people talking to you like that were like wiggers, right? It was specifically that. But like now, drag queen culture has infiltrated everything. It's like, I don't know. It's so weird to be like, hear a group of teenage white boys walking down the street who are presumably straight, like they look straight enough, and they'll be like, yeah, slay. And you're just like, where are we? You know? But I don't know if there's anything to like gatekeep, because I mean, the other thing that we don't like to admit is like, Black dialect has always been like the North American dialect, you know, white linguist was saying to me, and I'm from down South, right? And I remember when the question of Ebonics came up in the 90s and how disgusted all the redneck teachers I had were with that. And they were just like, why would they let them people speak that language? When in actuality, white Southerners speak the blackest dialect of any Americans. White Middle English says yay or nay. The reason white Southerners say nuh-uh, uh-huh, is because 500 years of the white gentry were raised by African women. You know? Like, stuff we say like hipster, cool, what's up, you know, that we think of as white language these days was all invented by Black hipsters. It was when I was reading fucking Lady Sings the Blues, by Billie Holiday, and realizing that jazz music also filtered into America because white men were going to Black brothels, right? And that's where they were hearing jazz music. And then it filtered in into the American lexicon. But at first, it was considered this very, like, vulgar kind of music,
right?
Just because of the bending of notes and its time signatures, and just considered so déclassé, right? I can't imagine listening to jazz and it being something along the lines of like Megan Thee Stallion, you know? I can't even like, the cultural shift around that is so crazy. But I think it's like, I don't know, I think it's the thing that always happens with all Blackness, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're always just, in order, and I do sometimes worry about this, too, maybe sometimes like with my work, it's like it always has to be viewed as so dirty or so exotic or so kind of wrong, when in actuality it's something that's very much telling the truth about humanness. And we watch it change in front of us, and then we watch it get stolen. So even when I watch Drag Race, I can't even like, you know, single it out. It's kind of been the story of America from the beginning.
Kind of jumping off of that, and you posted a story the other day that had, you know, me in the group chat in fucking tears. But the new Beyoncé album is allegedly a country album, and there were some criticisms of that and some people saying, you know, why is she going into this? I don't like this music. This isn't what she does, when country music is historically comes from Black Southern music, right?
The historically most stolen, like, really, if you went into like, there were a couple places that recorded it, but if you were Black, it was filed under race records and hidden. You know what I'm saying? Like, so like Black people always had a hand in country music. Hearing Azalea Banks though try to like talk about Beyonce, that was the part where I was just like, she's just like, oh, like, you're like, first of all, I love Azalea Banks, but sometimes, like, when Azalea is trying to come for Meg Thee Stallion or Beyonce, I'm like, okay, like, Azalea, you grew up in fucking Harlem. Sometimes I get so annoyed with Black Northerners, you know, because they grow up in this 1% jungle in the middle of the most secluded bubble in the world, and then, like, but they have access to all Blackness, right? Kind of same problem I have with ballroom. It's always about this 1% of Black culture that gets to borrow everything from all Blackness and then kind of take shots at the rest of us. And I'm like, yeah, Beyonce is like wearing a hat and singing country music, but most of those country stars don't drive horse and carriages. Like, country is about an artifice, right? And I'm like, Azalea, you rap about guns and shooting people, and you ain't shot no goddamn body. Like, hip-hop is as full of artifice as country music. We're all in a heightened reality with music here. What the fuck? Furthermore, Beyonce can do whatever the fuck she wants. Like, it's like, she just can, you know? So, it's, I don't know. I do think, though, this is the thing that I say, I think the country music record is what happens when people are out of ideas, because it's like, think about it. The Miley Cyrus country record, like not even when she was Hannah Montana, but after her hipster period, the Justin Timberlake country record, all of them made these country records. Who on earth bought that shit? Like, I still, like, it's never been described to me who the audience of that was for, but when I look at the Beyonce country record, I look at it the same way I look at, like, the Andre 3000 jazz flute record. It's like, these people have gone to the absolute edge of what they could do with their genre. They've proven themselves time and time again. Now they're at the point in their career where they want to experiment and they want to do the random weird shit they always wanted to do. And I think that that's fucking beautiful. I'd hope to get there myself one day.
And, you know, famously, I want to get this on a fucking t-shirt or somewhere. Bell Hooks tried to come for Beyonce, and then she died.
And she died. Like, come on. Like, come the fuck on. Dude.
So, closing out this episode, I couldn't not talk about our mutual Jackson Howard, the only non-writer we've ever had on the podcast, I'm pretty sure. I knew I wanted to interview him just because he's such a juggernaut in this scene. In 10 Bridges, you've written him this beautiful piece. Why do you think it's important that we start talking more openly about romantic friendship?
You know, it's not unlike a lot of relationships I have with my friends. Like, A, just between my abandonment issues and poor boundaries, I'm in love with all my friends. I think that all of the, you know what I'm saying? Like, my best girlfriends, everybody. I do believe that we all should be married. But also, I feel like I grew up in a period where we were very much taught that the nuclear family was the only way to have family. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us, I think more people than we know, had to deal with the fallout of what a lie that was. And I'm somebody who I think has answered more than enough questions about, like, what sex meant and what romance meant or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the older I get, you know, and there's just something about the fact that it's like, it's the people that pick up the phone whenever I call. It's the people that, I don't know, listen to me when something's wrong. It's the people that are kind of always there. So people that you pretty much think are going to be there to the day you die. Like, it takes on this new shape or pattern to me. And there was a time when I was, like, younger and in my 20s where all I wanted was, like, some boyfriend and just, like, sleep at his house and thought that that was going to be my life. But I don't know. As corny as it sounds, I really do feel like, you know, I wish I explored my friendships with people a little more, because I look back now, it's never really the boyfriends that I miss. It's like the boys that I came up with in San Francisco, like in my 20s, and just how cutthroat it was and how funny it was. And, you know, it's like we were all racing at the end of the night to get to some other boy's house, but we'd always actually just end up with each other kiki-ing and laughing the whole time. And, you know, that was so great. It was so electric. It still is, you know. I think as we explore kind of like relationships and paradigms and stuff like that. I think, I think it's something important to write about. Also, when I learned that like the Greeks had five different words for love, like there were five different like levels to it, you know, I was like, oh God, that sounds so specific. Like, and I think a lot of gay men have their best friend that they just love. Like, he's just like, he's like something like your right hand or whatever. How do you explain how important this man is to you without having some asshole be like, but is he your boyfriend? And you're like, yeah. It's not about that. Like, so.
out of curiosity, how many Jackson Howard dedication tattoos do you have at this point?
Seven?
When I interviewed Jackson, I think it was two. And I said, I think it's three. And he said, no, it's two. So I love that you're up to seven.
Yeah, I got five more just on a whim one night.
True love.
This is fiction.
Truly.
Can you imagine? That's funny.
That was good. All right, Brontes, that is all the time we have tonight. Thank you so much for doing this, for sitting with me. I promise we won't make you do any more podcast recordings until your next book.
Thank you so much. I love this.